Hello there, listeners, and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast on political thought about democracy, human rights, and pluralism. My name is Omar Sadr, and I am a senior research scholar at the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Governance and Markets. In this episode, I would like to discuss human rights. How do we have to advance claims for human rights? How do we counter massive human rights violations, such as that of Taliban's gender apartheid, denial of human freedoms, and finally, ethnic discrimination? I would like to also ask, is human rights a moral claim about certain truths, or as my guest in this episode, Michael Goodhart, suggests, human rights is not about moral truths, rather they are political claims against political domination, subjugation, and discrimination. Michael Goodhart is a professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh. His core research interests includes democracy, human rights, justice, emancipatory political struggles. He is author of a book titled Injustice, Political Theory of Real World, which is published in Oxford 2018, and another book called Democracy as Human Rights, Freedom and Equality in the Age of Globalization, published in 2005 by Routledge. On to the podcast, I invite you to listen to Michael Goodhart. Hi, Michael, and welcome to Negotiating Ideas podcast. It's good to have you here.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Omar.
You're welcome. I'm interested to talk to you about your contribution, scholarly contribution, about how do we understand human rights. And the unique thing is, I think you avoid falling in the trap of universalists versus relativists. This is interesting in contexts such as Middle East, Afghanistan, wherein you have a traditional society which relatively most of the time the conservative groups, Islamists usually, try to restrict or reread human rights based on certain cultural norms or religious norms. So that's a relativist stance, which at certain times also it leads to massive human rights violations. In case of Afghanistan, for example, people say it is gender apartheid. So help us and help the listeners understand how understanding human rights as a political contestation rather than trying to understand it from a culturalist standpoint, whether it's universalist or relativist, will probably provide us a better perspective to advance human rights and such kind of violatile context.
That's a big question. So let me give some general responses, and then maybe we can dig deeper into particular parts of it as you like. One thing I would say is that, you know, I think it's important to differentiate between universalism as a kind of norm that suggests that human rights are everywhere, always the same and unchanging and must be followed, and the kind of general and inclusive nature of human rights, which is what makes them appealing as a political tool for so many people, because they promise possibility for everyone. So I just want to distinguish those two different, they often are both called universalism, but I think they're, one is a kind of cultural universalism, right? It's an anti-relativism, as you suggesting. The other is about the normative content of human rights. It's about the kind of political project, if you will, that human rights support, and that's a general and inclusive one. So that's the first thing. The second thing to say is that human rights, if we understand them as moral principles, which must be followed somehow exactly as they've been formulated by whomever it happens to be, they lose a lot of their political efficacy. Because if, as you were just describing, again, if certain political factions, whoever they might be, whether they're cultural conservatives or whether they are religious authorities or whether they are socialists or others who might have a particular understanding, and they insist on that understanding, then human rights become exclusionary. Whereas if we understand human rights as a vocabulary or as a set of political tools through which people can make claims, and then focus on the ways in which those claims can be effective, precisely because the notion that everyone has human rights is one that really resonates in many, many different contexts, then I think we begin to see how the universalism versus relativism debate doesn't really speak to what I find at least most interesting about human rights, which is precisely this question of how people use them politically. So this is something I've written about before. There was an exchange with Jack Donnelly in a journal called Human Rights Quarterly 14 years ago or something now. It makes me feel old to say it. But and in that, he had written a piece called The Relative Universality of Human Rights, in which he was trying to make a claim that human rights are universal, but that there's room for negotiation and interpretation locally in different cultural contexts. And I wrote a response called Human Rights Neither Relative Nor Universal, in which I was trying to say, look, we should just stop thinking in those terms and try to think human rights much more politically.
So let me give you two particular examples and ask you to explain your hypothesis with respect to these two. So, of course, all human rights claims are contentious, but at some moment, probably societies may also settle the disputes over certain rights. For example, even a culturally conservative constituency may agree that there exists a right to property. But when it comes to right to life, for example, in the U.S., or right to conscience in Afghanistan under Taliban, right to have a freedom to leave a religion or freedom of thought, that is really controversial. How can we resolve this dispute in such a deeply religious, culturally embedded society, which, I mean, contentions over human rights is also coming from a certain normative standpoint?
So I think it's precisely where rights are most controversial that their political nature becomes most clear. As you suggested, a right like the right to life might be in some contexts uncontested. Interestingly, in the United States, because that particular phrase is a kind of code for debates about abortion and reproductive rights, the right to life, and also connects to the death penalty question, that right is very controversial, right? Whereas the right to free speech is treated as absolute. So it's always interesting to think about the different ways in which different rights appear to be uncontroversial in different contexts. So if I think about something like the claim to the right to free expression or free press or something like this, freedom of conscience, when that right is denied, either in practice or in principle, by political or social or religious authorities, it's usually in the service of a particular political agenda.
Yeah.
Right? They want to silence opponents. They want to prevent discussion of certain topics, whatever that might be. And so quite naturally, for people on the other side of that divide, whether it's cultural or religious, political, I'll just use the word political to capture all of that. For people on the opposite side of those political divides, it can be quite difficult to make an argument against a particular religious or political or cultural authority precisely because of their status, the status of those people or institutions as authorities. But what the advantage of human rights claims is, I think, is they do have this kind of global resonance. They do provide a vocabulary that everyone can take part of. And so when people are asserting, no, we have a right to free speech, there's a human right to free expression or to freedom of conscience, I think really what they're making is not some kind of moral claim, at least not in the first instance, about some absolute unchanging truth. Really what they're just saying is, we want to be able to say what we'd like to say, and this is a good vocabulary for appealing to that. And so the appeal to human rights is both about the resonance of those claims to different audiences, whether local or international, and also about the importance of the claim, right? So this thing is too important for us to be denied. And so it's precisely because of those that these rights claims are made. In fact, I think you could go so far as to say, and others have said this, you know, people really only assert their human rights in cases where they're being denied or threatened, right? There's no need for me to assert my human right to own property in the United States, because there's no question that that right is guaranteed. And one could go on and on multiplying examples. It's precisely in cases when people aren't enjoying their rights that they feel the need to claim them. And those are by definition always cases where politics is happening, right? Where there's asymmetrical power relations and where there's some kind of struggle going on in some particular space.
Yeah. But also, human rights is not a kind of pre-given fixed set of rights, but it's evolving as societies grow. For example, new technology presents new challenges, and so you will also need new set of rights to address, for example, the freedom of people or preserve their interests, fundamental interests. So in such kind of context, do you see a power relationship between those who are denied or those who are, for example, in new circumstances which are evolving? People may not be denied of their rights, but it's something that we have to think through and how to encounter this new situations.
I think you're right to say that rights are constantly evolving in response to new threats and challenges. But I also think you're right to suggest that sometimes it's not so much that a right is being denied than it is the case that simply people have identified something that poses a threat to their safety, well-being, dignity, whatever it might be, and that they recognize the importance of a protection against that threat or certain kinds of social, societal responses against that threat. And they'll assert a claim like that using, again, the vocabulary of human rights. And that can be everything from, you know, rights relating to digital privacy and the control of our personal information to genetic information and so on. It can also be, in some ways, much more mundane. Right here in Pittsburgh, we have an organization called Pittsburghers for Public Transit. And this group advocates that public transit is a human right. Now, you won't find any international treaty or covenant or any UN interpretation that says you have a right to a good bus system. But their argument is, look, in order to be able to enjoy the rights to work, the rights to enjoy our culture, the rights to healthcare and education, we need to be able to move around. Yeah. And if people don't have access to public transportation, they won't be able to. Now, we can bracket the question of, or I would say maybe, I don't find it helpful to ask questions like, is there really a right to public transportation?
Okay.
To me, it's the wrong kind of question. To me, what's interesting is what people are doing when they assert that there is a right to public transportation. And what they're doing is asserting, this thing is really important for us to be able to live decent and dignified lives. And that kind of claim, I think, is consistent across virtually all human rights claims.
Exactly. This is interesting because scholars coming from modus vivendi pluralism standpoint also problematizes legalistic approach to right claims, that you put a claim and said we have a right here, because that will harden, I mean, the fraction within society, and also it will create problem how to resolve these disputes. So they suggest that let the right claims be resolved politically and socially rather than legalistic through court, for example, arbitrations. But in societies like United States, as the rights are evolving, you will see societies becoming more and more divided and less, having a consensus on certain fundamental values. So do we have to be worried about this evolving set of rights or not?
You have two different kinds of answers to that question. On the one hand, I would say, I think that the point of human rights, what makes them valuable to political actors, whether it's in whatever social or political context they might find themselves in, regardless almost of the rights claim, what makes human rights valuable is that they are disruptive, right? To claim a human right in a particular context is to make a claim that something is wrong with existing social arrangements, right? That things are not going as they ought to, whether that's to do with education or religious freedom or you name it.
Yeah.
People are making an assertion that the status quo is somehow wrong, flawed, problematic. And so at that level, human rights will always be contentious because there are always claims about needing to refine or remake the social order in some fundamental way. And so in that respect, I'm not worried about controversy because I think that controversy is kind of inherent in the notion of what human rights are and what they're for. That being said, at another level, I think we can and should be worried about instances where we see the erosion of rights happening in a societal context. And that might look very different in different contexts, right? In Afghanistan, that's going to look like one set of things when the Taliban government is back in power.
Yeah.
In the United States, depending on where you sit politically, I think interestingly, on either side of like political divides in the United States, people think rights are being eroded. They just don't agree which rights and by whom, right? But it still looks quite different. And I think that we are correct to be concerned about that. But what's concerning is not, in a sense, that we've somehow lost agreement on the definition of what human rights are. What's concerning is that new social arrangements are coming into being that are problematic. And so in that sense, also, I think it's important to remember that, you know, human rights are political in another sense, and that is that to some extent, at least, they're partisan. They describe a kind of notion of dignity or freedom or a decent human existence, and it's not one that, frankly, everybody shares.
Yeah.
And so in that respect, they are inherently controversial.
Mm. And can we give an example of, moments where societies resolve these contentious claims peacefully, which did not disturb the integrity of society or that mutual coexistence between various segments of the society? For example, in case of Afghanistan, it's quite difficult to recall a moment that such kind of controversies resolved in a peaceful manner. Of course, there were moments. I'm not highlighting Afghanistan as an outlier amongst the rest. But what could be best examples of cases where human rights has helped societies to come along, and also settle on certain notions?
Your question makes me reflect about the fact that many of the examples that are frequently given of important human rights developments historically frequently come either through or in the wake of some kind of violence, whether that's a civil war or some other kind of conflict. And it's a bit, I'm struck by that fact as I'm listening to your question. So one example that I can think of, which is a largely peaceful example, obviously it involves political conflict and protest and so on, but the struggle for women's suffrage and women's rights in, say, the United States or the United Kingdom, which are just happen to be the two cases I know best, it was a long social struggle, but it was conducted largely peacefully and ultimately won, I think, through the hard work of changing people's minds and through persuasion, that ultimately suffrage advocates prevailed through the strength of good arguments and by appealing to kind of areas where there was shared moral or political agreement with their opponents, and they were able to win those rights successfully. Other instances, you know, again, because human rights are mostly, I think, invoked in cases where people aren't enjoying them. You know, we could say something like, well, there's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which lays out a bunch of principles, and the ones that aren't controversial simply aren't controversial. And that list of relatively uncontroversial rights is going to vary from place to place, but there will be some. And so and usually that's a reflection of the fact that societal values and traditions already reflected a respect for that particular right or that notion of rights. And that's very common, I think, in many places around the world. So what I think we typically see more often is that rights that have been unproblematic for a long time become problematic in a particular circumstance. So think, for instance, about examples like the breakup of the former Yugoslavia or the genocide in Rwanda. For many years, people across what we have come to understand as ethnic divides lived together perfectly peacefully without difficulty. There was intermarriage, there were neighborly relations among people. And then political circumstances changed, and those cleavages were politicized in ways that led to violence and to an erosion of people's rights. And so that's a phenomenon that unfortunately is common everywhere, that people with political ambition will sow divisions and try to foment conflict between different factions in order to advance their own agendas. And it's something we have to be constantly on guard against. But I guess I think that there are many places where most of the time most human rights are not controversial, and I take a lot of comfort in that. We tend to focus on those cases where rights are controversial, where they are being violated. But and then there are a couple of big exceptions to that: things to do with ill health and poverty, and these really problematic systemic issues that we tend not to sometimes frame in human rights terms. Those are maybe in a slightly separate category.
Mm-hmm. And if I go back to case of Afghanistan, the Western policy now with respect to Taliban is shaped by a conditionality of the regime respecting fundamental human rights. So necessarily, this is not a moral claim vis-a-vis the Taliban. So international community says, well, these are set of rights which are, practiced by the people of Afghanistan. It's their own claim, so you should respect it. But at the same time, you have another set of countries like China or Pakistan, Iran, Russia. While they're when they engage with Taliban, they do not evoke to human rights as a reference to their policy. Subtly they will say, well, we are okay with whatever approach of human rights you guys have with respect to your people. But the fact is that the West has not been successful in pushing the Taliban to accept human rights. To your mind, is it necessary for the West to put this condition of human rights, as many, of course, in Afghanistan do say the same thing? For example, the women who have been very courageous to stand against Taliban in the last two years. So what will be the appropriate way to encounter Taliban in this?
This is a really difficult question. I think you're absolutely right that the current policy of the U.S. government is not proving effective. And I think it's an interesting and important question, and one that we don't like to ask: how effective what we could call human rights conditionality, right? The idea that diplomatic relations, trade relations, economic aid, other things are conditional upon respect for human rights norms. It's an interesting question how effective human rights conditionality has been. Part of what has changed is the emergence of China as a major alternative source of aid, funding, support for governments around the world. There was a period of time, following the end of the Cold War through maybe until 10 or 15 years ago, maybe 10 is a better estimate, when really the United States and the EU and Japan, the OECD countries, let's put it that way, were really the only place to turn, whether that was in the form of the IMF or direct assistance from the US government or the EU or whatever it might have been. And so countries didn't have a lot of choice. So they would at least on paper make the kinds of reforms and commit to the kinds of policies that governments wanted to see. It's an interesting question and difficult to measure. How much changed in practice? How much of that was lip service that was paid in order to unlock the loans or the funds or the military hardware or whatever it was that governments wanted? But now that policy is eroded or further eroded by the existence of this alternative possibility of support from China and to a lesser extent some of the other countries that you that you mentioned. And so it raises a question, well, what would be the alternative? It certainly doesn't seem acceptable just to say we'll deal with any government regardless of its human rights record, and we'll take seriously. We won't take seriously anymore our commitments in this respect. But at the same time, if a policy doesn't work, it seems like it needs to be reconsidered. And so one thing I've thought about and I'd need to think more about is why the existing policies don't work. And it's partly, I think, because the policy sort of says, and this is, you know, being crudely simplistic about it, but we won't help until you fix X. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, I'm not saying this is true in Afghanistan or any other particular place, but let's assume for the sake of argument the government did want to change. But if they have to change as a condition of getting help, they might not be able to. There may be reasons why they're unable to implement those changes without assistance. And so to not work with others who aren't willing to make change sort of first is in a way to create a self-defeating structure. Now, it's the problem is different in the case of governments that are actually resistant to this kind of change. And, you know, I'll just confess, I'm a skeptic when it comes to how much international pressure of that kind can actually be effective. And in many instances, I think that kind of pressure actually inadvertently lends some support to governments in the following kind of way. A government might use U.S. refusal to negotiate or to release funds or to make loans or offer other kinds of assistance as a way of justifying the kinds of repressive policies that it implements, because it can say something to the effect of, well, look, they're trying to undermine us. They're constantly trying to overthrow us. We're working under the threat of regime change. We can't trust them. We need to implement these repressive measures in order to, you know, maintain social order, et cetera, et cetera. You're familiar with how this kind of argument goes. And even if it's not true, it lends a kind of support and maybe at least wins some sympathy for the government. I mean, much more effective where it's possible are kind of bottom-up movements from within a particular society that put pressure on governments. Obviously, in cases where the government is extremely repressive, think of contemporary Myanmar, for instance, or what's going on now in Afghanistan, or lots of other examples, those kinds of movements are repressed quite thoroughly and effectively. And so it's frankly hard to see what can really be done in those cases. And I think for many of us, for very good reasons, it seems extremely uncomfortable and problematic to say there may not be much we can do. But I think in some instances, under the current conditions, there may not be much we can do. I tend to think that by the time we get to these acute crises, serious state repression, famine, whatever it might be, in a sense, we're past the point where it makes sense to think in terms of human rights strategies. Now we've just got a disaster of one kind or another, whether natural or human made. The goal, I think, has to be to work to create structures and systems that that build up support for human rights gradually when we're not in these cases of acute crisis. I don't have good answers about what to do, but I at least take comfort from the fact that I'm in good company because no one else seems to have any good answers.
Yeah. Well, some other scholars, for example, Andrew Markoff, University of Massachusetts, who came up recently with a policy paper at USIP, argues that those countries who wants to convince Taliban or push Taliban, or for that matter, for example, you can also say about Iran, which is also a similar type of regime, they have to justify their claims, their arguments, based on certain form of moderate Islamic theology, which accommodates human rights notions. So that's because he argues that Taliban ideology or policies are deeply rooted into the classic Sunni Islam jurisprudence. So he says, if you don't do that, when it's very little, there's little scope that Taliban will be convinced to change this policy. So this brings to my mind that the idea of cross-cultural foundation for human rights, which certain other scholars, for example, Abdullahi al-Naim argued, or Dr. Jack of University of Denver has tried to propose that one. So do you really think in such kind of situation, like Iran or Afghanistan, we don't have to consider some certain level of cross-cultural foundation for our claims?
So first, I would want to reemphasize that because I don't think of human rights as kind of fixed moral claims, I think that they have many different foundations and different kinds of contexts, and that it's not particularly important that there be consensus or agreement about what those are. I think there are many different resources within different traditions for justifying human rights, and that what makes most sense is going to vary a lot by context. That being said, I'm skeptical that the problem with the Iranian regime or the Taliban is that they're not thinking about human rights in the right way. The problem is they're oppressive regimes that want to maintain power because it's in their interest to maintain power. True. And if that's the case, I don't see that the problem is, it seems to me that the wrong illness has been diagnosed, if you will. It seems to me that the prescription is not appropriate to the malady. If I genuinely thought that the Iranian regime was simply confused or going about trying to justify their arguments and policies in the wrong way, and that reasonable persuasion would solve the problem, that would be one thing. But I simply think they're looking for ways to maintain power.
Yeah.
And the only way that that's going to be solved, and we see this quite consistently, is through bottom-up social change. And this is why they react so vehemently whenever these kinds of protest movements break out, whether it's around the elections a while back or more recently around the murder of the young woman who refused to wear her headscarf, and all of the protests that erupted following this. Those are repressed quite harshly. And that has nothing to do with international pressure, right? That's domestic pressure. That's pressure from the bottom up. And so, it's then tempting to think in terms of, well, what can countries do to support those kind of local bottom up movements? But that itself proves tricky, right? Because there was a very ambitious campaign in the 1990s to build civil society. This was the term that was used following the end of the Cold War, and groups like the Open Society Institute and many others, the EU, USAID, invested billions of dollars in building civil society. And that looked like it was effective for a while in some places, but now it's come back to be used as a weapon against some of those very groups. You see in places like Russia or Hungary or Turkey or others, where receiving Western funding, as it's frequently called, is a claim that's used to delegitimize certain kinds of groups and to shut them down. Now, again, I think at some level that's just rhetoric. These groups are actually being shut down because they caused the regime some kind of difficulty, whether it's embarrassment or whether because they're helping to serve as the locus for social movements or whatever it might be. But nonetheless, it does show that even that strategy has limitations. Nonetheless, I think ultimately that's been more successful. And again, I'd have to study this more carefully empirically to be able to make claims that I feel like I could really stand by. But I feel like those strategies of building civil society, supporting local groups, whatever, have been maybe more successful than the kind of traditional model of diplomatic pressure, which, to be honest, other than a couple... Sorry, let me say one more thing. This is becoming a long answer. I think the view that international pressure could be effective in forcing regimes to change is an artifact of a couple of cases from Latin America from the 1980s where that kind of pressure proved really effective. So a number of important scholars in the field of human rights, Margaret Keck, Catherine Sickink, and others, really paid attention to what came to be called first the boomerang and then the spiral model, yeah. where domestic groups would appeal to the international community to put pressure on governments to make changes. And that seemed to work. But I think as we've gone on, you know, there are real questions about how much that model is generalizable to different kinds of circumstances. And the authors of that work have gone back as recently as around 2013 and reconsidered again how broadly the spiral model applies. But I do think that at a minimum, we can think about the conditions in which that kind of approach is likely to be successful, and then recognize that it's not likely to be successful in all circumstances. Yeah. There were particular things going on there in the 80s that made that work.
Having said that, so the last question I will ask is, what will be your advice to human rights defenders in Iran or in Afghanistan where they encounter very kind of religious totalitarian regimes, how they should mobilize for defending human rights?
It's a very difficult question to answer from the outside. And I would just want to, before I venture any kind of suggestion, I would just want to say how much I respect and admire the work that people are doing and, express my solidarity with that work. I'm certainly in no position to tell others how best to do this work. I guess I would simply say that what seems to me in examples I know best to have been effective is to use local, and by that I mean, you know, the local culture, religious resources, wherever they might be, draw on those things to build up support for these human rights norms. Don't necessarily try to appeal to outsiders or to international understandings of what human rights really mean. Own the claims for themselves, and by owning the claims, to make them in a language and a vocabulary and to articulate them in a way that resonates with other people, I think that building that kind of massed strength and solidarity is really the best hope. And I think that very often that can be achieved through trying to put human rights into the vernacular, if you will. Sally Engel Mary, an anthropologist who worked on human rights throughout her really illustrious career, used this term of the vernacularization of human rights. When you take this universal or global, I prefer the term global language, and bring it down into the local context and really translate it and use it, shape it, fit it to the local circumstances to make it political. That seems to me the best hope. And unfortunately, it's no guarantee, but I think it's at least there's at least the promise and the potential for change. And I try to remain hopeful.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Michael, for your time. It was nice talking to you.
Thanks very much, Omar, for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And finally, thanks to our listeners for listening to this episode. I hope you all enjoyed listening to Michael. Please subscribe to this podcast and make sure to share it widely with your friends on social media. I'm looking forward to speaking to you on the next session. Have a nice day.